Good evening. Welcome to the Slayer Report. Today is January 24th, 2019, and this is the last audio presentation of our 2018 annual wrap-up. Our theme is The Real Game of Missing Money, and this is Catherine Austin Fitz. I'm delighted you could join me this evening. The most important event that happened in Washington over the last 12 months was the adoption of Statement 56 by the Federal Accounting Standards Advisory Board. It slipped through in October 2018, was adopted during the Kavanaugh hearings, which was a remarkable coincidence because it went through when the Shriekometer was turned to full volume, which was a volume all about sex. Reminded me of when the $21 trillion started to go missing. That was covered up by Monica Lewinsky's blue dress and talk of oral sex in the Oval Office. For a full discussion of FASB 56, see our special report. You can find it linked from our homepage or in the Federal Finances Law section on the web presentation for the annual wrap-up. The public version, which you link to from our homepage, is available to everyone if you want to share it with any members of the public. And of course, remember, you can always share your web presentation or Slayer Report material with immediate family. FASB Statement 56 authorizes secret books, which when you combine it with waivers that the government can permit related companies and entities to keep, you take a large part of the U.S. economy and securities market dark. Why is an obscure accounting policy adopted through the offices of the GAO and OMB, that's the Government Accountability Office that works for Congress, and the Office of Management and Budget that works for the White House, why is that the most important political event of the last year? Because it converted what has been up to date a financial coup d'etat, which I've been covering for two decades, into a legal coup d'etat. As a legal matter, a secret group of people by a secret process can allocate tax dollars and securities proceeds from the largest securities issuer in the world by whatever manner they want and do it in secret. And it occurred after a significant effort to hold the Department of Defense accountable for $6.5 trillion missing in federal fiscal 2015, in which the DOD admitted they couldn't complete an audit. This fundamentally changes the governance structure of the United States and fundamentally changes the credit of any U.S. or U.S.-related bond, as well as stocks and companies whose revenues and profits flow from government-related products and services. That means this is a material event. It's a material event for citizens. It's a material event for investors. And that applies to citizens' investors, both globally and domestically. As a result of what happened, I decided to change our theme for the annual wrap-up, The Real Game, to The Real Game of the Missing Money. I was going to do the annual wrap-up on the theme that we'll have for the first quarter on ESG financing and investment. But when FASB Statement 56 went final, I realized, okay, this is very material. And it's extremely important in combination with the numerous efforts by the corporate media to downplay it, as well as the $21 trillion missing from the U.S. government. It's very important that I collect together in one place the information that serious citizens and investors need to do due diligence as to what has happened and what it means to you and your assets and what you can or should do about it. Now, many of you will ask, what can I do? It's too depressing. I don't want to look at it unless you tell me what I can do. There are many things you can do, but the first and most important thing you need to do is to face what is happening and what it implies for how the United States and the world will be governed in the future. And then you need to connect it to your unique situation. Everyone is different, but the operations and finances that we're talking through thread throughout many different aspects of your life, I suspect far more than many of you are aware of. My experience is that it's critical for each person to thoroughly digest what is happening and see things as they are before they consider what actions they want to take. So getting an accurate map is very important. My father was a surgeon, so I always think in terms of surgery. But you really don't want your neurosurgeon to to cut until he has a very accurate map of your brain and knows exactly what he needs to do, or she needs to do, he or she needs to do, and why. There are three things about FASB Statement 56 that are important for you to understand. I want to discuss each one of them in some detail. The first thing is that this was an action taken with the full support of both executive branch and Congress, and bipartisan congressional support in both the House and the Senate. The General Accounting Office works for Congress, all of the Congress. The Office of Management and Budget works for the Trump administration. Both the Trump administration and all the Democrats and Republicans in the Senate and House all agreed to do this. So did every one of them focus on it? Probably not, but all the leadership knew. And I'm sure they believed that it was important in terms of handling the Treasury market and the bondholders. And I'm assuming that from October, the primary dealers, who are the group of firms that market the auctions and the initial issuance of Treasury securities, I'm sure the primary dealers are all out assuring large creditors that this is the kind of central control and leadership that gives basically the people who run the Treasury auction, the finances, including the members of the owners of the New York Fed. This gives them the power to ensure that the people's elected officials cannot interfere with the actions necessary to ensure creditor rights and market liquidity. So I can easily see the primary dealers making a strong case that this makes it easier for the people you can trust to make sure your creditor rights are protected to do their duty. It reminds me of a famous statement by James Carville, the political consultant, who said during the Clinton administration, quote, "I used to think that if there was reincarnation, I wanted to come back as president of the Pope or as a 400 baseball hitter. But now I would like to come back as the bond market. You can intimidate everybody." It would not surprise me if Nancy Pelosi's reinstitution of PAYGO, which is a budget rule in the Congress that says you can only spend money if you can identify a source to pay for it, was connected to the implementation of FASB 56. That was part of the deal, because it makes the secret money all the more important and powerful. So number one is, please understand, this was the single most important event that happened in Washington last year, was a bipartisan action with the full support of the Trump White House and the General Accounting Office, which means a bipartisan okie-dokie from the leadership on both sides of the aisle in both Senate and House. That's what you need to understand. Very important comment on what's really going on in Washington. Okay, that's number one. Number two, secret armies. Matt Taibbi of Rolling Stone just wrote a very good piece on FASB 56. We publish it in News Trends and Stories. You can also pick it up at Rolling Stone under his it was on the cover when it first came out, but you can pick it up under his section. So here's what I wrote him when he was trying to grapple with what this was about. Quote, "The story is simple and obvious. What is it about secret financing for secret armies that you do not understand? The U.S. government just officially changed its governance model from a constitutional republic to fascism through an obscure accounting policy. No need to bother with a constitutional convention. The U.S. Treasury is free to tax and then borrow from our pension funds and global and domestic investors and transfer the money and assets financed and technology found or created without limit or oversight to private corporations, investors without compensation or oversight. This is privatization by the just do it method. Think of this as an extension of the bailouts to a permanent open bailout structure. The U.S. government just announced that it's sticking a pipeline into the back of Treasury and announced to every private army, mercenary, and thug in the world that they are open for business. Why do you think Mattis is suddenly out and Blackwater is running ads that Blackwater is coming and Eric Prince is testifying that we could use mercenaries in Syria? I would also note that the U.S. military announced that they're planning on recruiting from a group of people who are not citizens but have green cards. Now, I think probably many Americans would prefer they do that than have a draft, but if you populate the military with people who have green cards, it's a military that's willing to enforce against the U.S. citizens. So the combination is very sobering. Perhaps most sobering is once FASB 56 got put into place, or when FASB 56 got put into place, it was relatively subsequent, immediately subsequent by Washington timetables, to a group of the military, Mattis, Dumford, and Kelly, using their gravitas and credibility to arrange phenomenal increases in military appropriations. So they used their gravitas to achieve the increase in appropriations for the military. FASB 56 gets put into place, and suddenly, clean sweep, all the Marines are out, Mattis, Dumford, Kelly out. And who's in Kelly's place at the White House, running the White House? It's the guy at OMB who engineered FASB 56 is now the chief of staff. Okay? That's a very clear message about what's coming next in terms of engineering the U.S. government and the pivot of the national security state, bringing back a lot of its outsourcing into America. So if we're going to have a radical reengineering of the U.S. government bureaucracy, which I believe is underway, and I think that's first and foremost what the shutdown is about, as well as re-engineer land use as demonstrated by, you name it, 9/11, the fires in California, various instances of weather warfare across the country. And you look at the related provisions of disaster recovery funding going through Washington. The ability to field and fund secret private armies without limit is a very critical development, and you need to understand what it may mean to the next 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years. You know, we are rebuilding America with a wholly new vision, and the team that's doing it is now free to rock and roll. The third thing, so number one is this was both sides of the aisle and both White House and Congress. Second thing is secret armies. We have been building mercenary private companies that do mercenaries, and that capacity has been building ever since we started the wars in the Middle East after 9/11, and that infrastructure is hungry and are very creative in terms of creating ways to keep the game going in terms of improving corporate earnings and improving the campaign contributions that run from those corporate earnings. Okay, number three. I said three things. We are experiencing a very significant change in the deep state leadership with David Rockefeller dead in 2017 and now George H.W. Bush dead. And what we're watching is the Marines out, Kelly, Dumford, Mattis out, and Bushy's in, although I would include Mattis as one of the Bushy crowd. But we have Kavanaugh in the Supreme Court, Powell into the Federal Reserve, and now Barr going in as Attorney General. The FASB was done by the Bushy crowd. I'll bet you a dollar that Nick Brady, former Secretary of the Treasury under George H.W. Bush when Barr was Attorney General, was involved, if not engineered, the FASB creation process. When he was Secretary of Treasury, he was part, with OMB and GAO, of creating a Treasury, was part of the process then. The way they would have done this is they would have had a commission-like process. They would have touched base and discussed the problem likely with the other secretaries of Treasury that are alive. Rubin, Summers, Lew were likely part of the process. Probably John Hawke is my guess for somebody who would have been in there. The big accounting firms, the big black budget law firms, which is one of the reasons I think it's so disturbing that the former Sullivan & Cromwell chairman is recently died, as we discussed last week in Money and Markets. Of course, Mnuchin was skull and bones at Yale, and it's very much a Yale-Harvard crowd that's running this. It very much reminds me of the movie The Good Shepherd. If you haven't seen it, really, it's a must to understand governance in America. There's a wonderful scene where Edmund Wilson is played by Matt Damon, and he's basically senior in covert operations at the CIA. And one of the mafiosos who they do business with, he's in Miami, is looking at him and he's quizzical. It's played by Joe Pesci. And I've put the scene up many times in the Solaria Report, but I'll just read it to you again. Let me ask you something. I'm going to change one of the descriptions of African Americans from the one that they use in the movie. Let me ask you something. We Italians, we got our families and we got the church. The Irish, they have their homeland, Jews, their tradition. Even the N people, they got their music. What about you people, Mr. Wilson? What do you have? And Wilson looks at him and he says, the United States of America. The rest of you are just visiting. And I think it's very important that you understand the group the group that I'm describing, particularly that Bushy crowd who were, I was very much part of that world. That's the way they look at it. This is their money, not our money. And this is their operation, not our operation. And they're going to do whatever they're going to do. And we're not a part of it. I think one of the best descriptions, Paul O'Neill basically had to leave as Secretary of the Treasury because he couldn't get along with the crowd under George W. Bush and Cheney. And in his book that he helped us, Ron Suskind, write, he has a very famous quote about an aide speaking to him. Let me just read it. And many people believe it's attributed to Karl Rove, but that's not definite. The aide said that guys like me were, quote, in what we call the reality-based community, quote, which he defined as people who believe that solutions emerge from your judicious study of discernible reality. Quote, that's not the way the world really works anymore, he continued. We're an empire now, and when we act, we create our own reality. And when you're studying that reality judiciously, as you will, we'll act again, creating other new realities, which you can study too, and that's how things will sort out. We're history's actors, and you, all of you, will be left to just study what we do. Now, if you look at the group of leadership that has run America since 1963, there was enormous continuity in leadership because you had a group of people who engineered the assassination of John Kennedy, President Kennedy, in 1963, and engineered the subsequent cover-up. And being in on that kill was a very important part of creating this. You were kind of in the group or you weren't, and there was nothing you could do to really get in the group if you weren't in on the kill, so to speak. Now, I'm oversimplifying, but it's important to understand that there's been extraordinary continuity. And with Rockefeller and Bush dying, the group that killed Kennedy is basically dying and disappearing from power. And that means a new group has to emerge and come up. And that process is making things very fluid. I'm going to talk a lot more about it with Harry Blaser when we publish part two on the deep state, this one on the Kennedy assassination and cover up with Harry Blaser, and it'll publish in the, I think, the second or third week of February. So that we is leaving and you have a younger, new leadership, and that leadership feels even less of a connection or commitment to the general population than the last one. And in combination, that fluidity of leadership and that younger leadership combined with the pivot to the USA has made what has happened in the last 2 years in terms of disaster capitalism, whether it's the fire or weather warfare, it means they're moving fast and do not intend to share their plans with the wider population. And the part of their challenge is the free spending after 9/11 built up an unbelievably expensive national security infrastructure. It's a huge complex that's not efficient. They threw a lot of pork and money around. And the problem is that whole edifice it really is a tapeworm, especially if they let the mercenaries go free to figure out how to get more money to keep it fed. So in addition, you have a large society highly dependent on large amounts of subsidy that's not organized for this kind of change or any kind of high performance in this world. It's not surprising businesses' number one complaint is they can't find the kind of employees they need, because if you look at what we needed to do starting in the early 90s to make sure people had the skills necessary to be part of this world, you know, we did the opposite. Instead of encouraging them to get the skills, we encouraged them to go into debt and have a party. So when you add on top of this that the federal control has been asserted on the 5G rollout, so that literally states and localities have no say supposedly in stopping 5G, what it says is to make this change at high speed, they're very dependent on the one-way mirror and mind control to manage the change. So the bottom line is the storm is upon us. It's not coming. It's here. We're in it. So I think it's very important to be careful about listening or believing any predictions of what is going to happen in the future. The future is very fluid, and we have to see how it's going to go. But most important, you have to have a vision of how you can be successful in this environment, no matter how it goes. But you need to base that vision on an accurate map of reality. I should note, I hope to have the scenarios. If you look in the section, get ready, get ready, get ready. I hope to have those scenarios done by the time we put this to bed by the end of the month. And those scenarios will be designed to help you use four different scenarios to help you with your planning. I should note in the get ready section, there is a schedule of events for the year. So you might want to take a look at that because I think it's always helpful to see what events are baked into the cake for the year ahead. And we use that schedule internally. And this year I decided, hey, given how fluid the leadership is, I'm going to put that up for subscribers. It'll help them with their planning. Who should care? Who should care? Who's going to be impacted by this? Let's take a look at the different groups. The first party who should care is investors. The officially reported U.S. Treasury debt is starting to expand at a very rapid pace. The outstanding debt disclosed in official reports is now greater than our annual GDP, so it's almost up to $22 trillion. And it's expanding at an accelerating rate. The Treasury debt grew by 6% in 2018, and it's expected to grow by 8% in 2019. And that's despite many years of what's being called an economic recovery. If the economy slows or it goes into recession, the debt growth is going to accelerate. And if you add unfunded liabilities, the picture deteriorates even further. I really want to encourage you to watch a presentation by someone I consider to be the best bond manager that I know of in America. His name is Jeff Gundlach, and he runs a firm called Double Line. You can find their website at doubleline.com. And every year he does a oversight of the financial markets, just sort of an overview. And if you go to doubleline.com and click on webcasts, you can find his January webcast. And the last 20 minutes, I would listen to the whole thing, but the last 20 minutes focuses on the combination of federal debt and the significant maturities and rollovers of corporate debt. The two are going to clash into each other, smack right in like two tsunamis going at each other. One of the things he points out, if you look at the increase in debt of 6% last year, the deficit was $800 billion, but the debt went up by $1.3 trillion because floods, natural disasters, one-off military expenditures, and the Social Security system meant that the actual cash expenditures were much greater. And if you look at the disaster capitalism, there's no doubt there's a giant sucking sound out of the federal budget. And I think my guess is the number they're showing is small because I think they're also pulling money out of the mortgage funds is what I believe. So what Gundlach predicted was that the what he says is the first 3 months of fiscal 2019, the debt grew by $458 billion. That's an annualized basis of almost $2 trillion. If the debt growth keeps increasing at a same rate, which is about 30% a year, you can imagine what's going to happen. And that is, the question is, where is the capital going to come from? Currently, foreign investors hold about 30% of the outstanding treasury debt. If anything, they're downsizing their positions. One, we're having a trade war with China, and China's looking to expand the global liquidity of their own currencies and bond markets rather than keep ours going. You have foreign countries and central banks grappling with their own high levels of debt the way we kept the global recovery going, in one sense, was by levering up the emerging markets. So now both the developed world and the emerging markets are levered up. And you also have a lot of people who fear economic sanctions, and so they wish to reduce their dollar dependency. If you add it all up, what it means is that it's unlikely foreign sovereign wealth funds and central banks will provide a significant source of fresh funds to the U.S. Treasury market. As I said, you also have significant increases in corporate debt maturities over the next 5 years. So the corporations are going to be competing fiercely, particularly for global private investors and the funds sitting in offshore havens. Please note that as all the money went missing from the federal government, the offshore havens balances grew and grew and grew. It's a remarkable symmetry. The U.S. investors own about almost $7 trillion, which is about 33% of the outstanding debt. And then the federal government owns, and that's Social Security, and I suspect there's a lot in the ESF fund, owns about 27%, and the Federal Reserve owns 11%. So the alternative is we can monetize the debt by the Federal Reserve buying, although they say they're not buying, they're reducing bond holdings that ballooned during quantitative easing. The U.S. government can't buy more, really, unless significant immigration in theory could bring money into Social Security or lessen the outflow, which is one of the drivers for immigration. But I suspect the U.S. government has been levering up the ESF by essentially, you know, the money getting missing is getting pulled out and sent into different trading vehicles that can then buy lots and lots of treasuries on a leveraged basis. So the ESF and its trading partners, I'm sure, have some. But both of those simply monetizes the debt from my point of view, and that means more and more inflation, monetary inflation. Finally, of course, there's U.S. investors, so it means our pension funds buy more. And I think part of raising the interest rates by the Fed was to get the pension funds to keep buying treasuries as their debt matures. But the other is retirement accounts. There was a big effort coming into the bailout period to talk about mandating treasury purchases for IRAs, 401ks, and other kinds of retirement accounts. And it wouldn't surprise me to see the pressure increase to start to do that. The pushback last time was so significant that those plans disappeared from the discussion pretty quickly. One of the most important issues that investors are going to have to grapple with when they consider what FASB Statement 56 means is whether or not the United States government owns the assets that their bonds and purchases are financing. So I'm an investor. I buy a treasury bond. The money goes into treasury. It buys an asset. It buys a ship, it buys a plane, it buys a piece of land, it builds a building. Is the asset owned by the government or is it being transferred out the back door into private corporations? We know that a great deal of responsibility and assets have been transferred to private corporations, in part because that's a way to keep those operations secret. I did a great interview with Amy Benjamin last year on secrecy, and I would strongly recommend that you listen to that. But the reality is another way you can support corporate earnings and balance sheets is simply by transferring the asset out of government into a corporation. Who knows? Who cares? The transfer out will be protected by FASB 56. There are some who argue that it wouldn't, but I would argue that it could, particularly if securities fraud is involved. And which I think is, given the history of the U.S. government, is relatively easy to do. And so FASB 56 says you don't see it transferred out. And if you look at the waivers applying to private corporations, those waivers make sure you don't see it arrive. But the market, you know, the inside players will know, and so the stock market does very well. Never underestimate the ability of this process to deliver steroids to private corporations. So you need to decide, is your credit different if the government owns the assets you're financing? But if those assets are being or some portion of them are being transferred out of the back door into private corporate hands, and the contracts that you're funding with government contractors is building new technology and databases and knowledge that they own and not the government, does that impact your credit? In other words, if the U.S. government marketing is simply a marketing shell and doesn't really own the powerful assets you're financing, does that impact your credit? And does it impact the price at which you're willing to take that risk, that the politics of the entity will be different if it owns the assets than if it does? More on that in the paper, the section that we're publishing on investors' issues. And as I said, don't be surprised if the primary dealers are assuring the large bondholders that FASB Statement 56 assures the leadership the power and control they need to protect creditors' rights from populace. But I would argue, au contraire, you know, if those assets are long gone, it's a very different credit. in defense of the leadership, I think it's important to understand how we got here. One thing I will tell you is the money started to shift out of the federal government after the inability to reach a budget deal in 1995. And there was quite a chorus of the pain from the leadership that there was no constituency for financial responsibility, which is absolutely true. You know, the last 30 years of my life is proof positive that it is extremely difficult to build a constituency for financial responsibility, particularly if you have $21 trillion to buy everybody and everything. But when Rubin took money out of the Exchange Stabilization Fund during the budget shutdown in 1995, I think it scared the bejesus of the people who run the hidden system of finance and the black budget. And that was when, that was the time at which the president of CalPERS referred to when he said, they've given up all the on the country, they're moving all the money out in the start of the fall. And of course, that's when we started to globalize and to get a great deal of capital to, you know, so you hiccup the world and jam prices down worldwide, and then you bubble the U.S. economy and the dollar. And so your dollar is high and you can pick up equity cheap and you go around the world. And it's like one of those, if you ever saw the old game show where they take the shopping cart and you get to keep everything you can throw into your cart for the next 10 minutes. It's kind of a supermarket sweep, if you will. Anyway, so we've had since then an engineered financial coup d'etat. We have $21 trillion of missing money and $24 trillion of bailouts. You know, I know they say they paid the money back. I'll believe it when I see it. And how would you know the books aren't reliable? The result has been a tremendous centralization of assets and ownership globally. I just thought I would return for a little oldie but goodie. One of the most popular articles I ever published was an article I published in February of 2009 about something that had happened to me in 2001. And the article is called, it's the original financial coup d'etat article. So I kept struggling before the bailouts and then during the bailouts to warn people how big what was happening was. And it was extremely hard for many Americans to fathom, you know, what a privatization by just-do-it method on a global scale would look like. But let me read this. In the fall of 2001, I attended a private investment conference in London to give a paper, The Myth of the Rule of Law or How the Money Works, The Destruction of Hamilton Securities Group. The presentation documented my experience with the Washington Wall Street Partnership that had engineered a fraudulent housing and debt bubble, illegally shifted vast amounts of capital out of the United States, used privatization as a form of privacy, a pretext to move government assets to private investors at below market prices, and then shift private liabilities back into government at no cost to the private liability holder. Other presenters at the conference included distinguished reporters covering privatization in Eastern Europe and Russia. As the portraits of British ancestors stared down upon us, we listened to story after story of global privatization throughout the 1990s in the Americas, Europe, and Asia. Slowly, as the pieces fit together, we shared a horrifying epiphany. The banks, the corporations, the investors acting in each global region were the exact same players. They were a relatively small group that appeared again and again in Russia, in Eastern Europe, and Asia, accompanied by the same well-known accounting firms and law firms. Clearly, there was a global financial coup d'etat underway. The magnitude of what was happening was overwhelming. In the 1990s, millions of people in Russia had woken up to find their bank accounts and pension funds simply gone, eradicated by a falling currency or stolen by mobsters who laundered money back into big New York Fed member banks for reinvestment to fuel the debt bubble. Reports of politicians, government officials, academics, and intelligence agencies facilitating the racketeering and theft were compelling. One lawyer in Russia, living without electricity and growing food to prevent starvation, was quoted as saying, "We are being demodernized." Several years earlier, I listened to three peasant women describe the war on drugs in their respective countries, Colombia, Peru, and Bolivia. I asked them, after they sweep you into camps, who gets your land and at what price? My question opened a magic door. They poured out how the real economics worked in the war on drugs, including the stealing of land and government contracts to build housing for the people who were displaced. At one point, suspicious of my understanding of how this game worked, one of the women said, You say you have never been to our countries, yet you understand exactly how the money works. How is this so? I replied that I had served as Assistant Secretary of Housing at the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development in the United States, where I oversaw billions of government investment in U.S. communities. Apparently, it worked the same way in their countries as it worked in mine. I later found out that the government contractor leading the war on drugs strategy for U.S. aid to Peru, Colombia, and Bolivia was the very same contractor in charge of knowledge management for HUD enforcement. This Wall Street Washington game was a global game. The peasant women of Latin America were up against the same financial pirates and business model as the people in South Central Los Angeles, West Philadelphia, Baltimore, and the South Bronx. Later, courageous reporting by several independent investigative reporters confirmed in detail that the privatization and economic warfare model I discussed in London had deep roots in Latin America. We are experiencing a global heist. Capital is being sucked out of country after country. The presentation I gave in London revealed a piece of the puzzle that was difficult for the audience to fathom. This was not simply happening in the emerging markets. It was happening in America, too. I described a meeting that had occurred in April 1997, more than 4 years before that day in London. I'd given a presentation to a distinguished group of U.S. pension fund leaders on the extraordinary opportunity to re-engineer the U.S. federal budget. I presented our estimate that the prior year's federal investment in the Philadelphia, Pennsylvania area had a negative return on investment. We presented that it was possible to finance places with private equity and re-engineer the government investment to a positive return, and as a result, generate significant capital gains. Hence, it was possible to use U.S. pension funds to significantly increase retirees' retirement security by successfully investing in American communities, small business, and farms, all in a manner that would reduce debt, improve skills, and create jobs. The response from the pension fund investors to this analysis was quite positive, until the president of the CalPERS pension fund, the largest in the country, said, "You don't understand. It's too late. They have given up on the country. They're moving all the money out in the fall." That's the fall of 1997. "They're moving it to Asia." Sure enough, that fall, significant amounts of money started leaving the U.S., including illegally. Over $4 trillion went missing from the U.S. government. That's the number that's now $21 trillion. No one seemed to notice, misled into thinking we're in a boom economy by a fraudulent debt bubble, engineered with force and intention from the highest levels of the financial system. Americans were engaging in an orgy of consumption that was liquidating the real financial equity we needed urgently to reposition ourselves for the times ahead. The mood that afternoon in London was quite sober. The question hung in the air, unspoken. Once the bubble was over, was the time coming when we too would be demodernized? In 2009, more than 7 years later, this is a question that many of us are asking ourselves. This re-engineering of the global government systems using debt and privatization, or what I call piratization, has been underway for quite some time. It's coming to America. It's in America now. The message of the California fires, it's underway, and it's going to continue. Okay, so the number one party who should care is investors. The number two party who should care is U.S. citizens or residents. If you are a U.S. citizen, you are an investor. You may not buy Treasury securities, you may not own Treasury securities, but your pension fund does if you have one. Or the pension funds that you're liable for in your state and city have owned lots of Treasury securities, they're impacted. And you will be too if those bonds don't produce an interest or lose their value over time. Your bank owns lots of Treasury securities. A great deal has been done to either force or encourage banks, instead of loaning their money locally, to loan their money to the Treasury Department through their securities portfolio. Your insurance company likely owns a great deal of Treasury securities. Your municipality and their reserve funds and all sorts of funds that they keep have big positions, and your state, so municipality and state. But if you look around you as to how much of your tax dollar and how much of your investment dollar is going into treasuries, whether you know it or not, it's quite extraordinary. Now, some of us have 401ks or IRAs. And as I said earlier, it's possible you could become an investor by mandates. So you are an investor. You're also a guarantor. During the time that I was working with the Gold Group from GATA, they sent a letter to the Treasury Department asking them whether or not they reserve the right to seize gold. And they wrote back and said, we reserve the right to seize all your property. If the assets are leaving the government and moving onto the balance sheet of private corporations, the assets ultimately that creditors can look to secure their positions are your property. And of course, with FASB 56 and all these other things, if there are plenty of mercenary armies to seize your property to turn over to creditors, the legal mechanisms are now pretty much in place to do that. I'll never forget one entrepreneur who I worked with on the first Missing Money website who said, you know, I used to think I owned my home until I met Catherine, and then I realized, no, the U.S. Treasury creditors own my home. So the second party who cares is a U.S. citizen or resident. But finally, you should also care because under the Constitution, we are responsible for the operation of the government and to ensure that it operates inside the Constitution and the law, which it doesn't. So we all need to think about what a country we want to have and what we can do to move us back towards a more democratic process, an economy which is efficient and is run to produce wealth as opposed to run to control centrally. The third party who should care is a U.S. government employee or business dependent on government money. And that could include government employees at state and local level. I doubt the feds will fire the civil service quickly. They'll let it die off. But it's going to be increasingly perilous and increasingly an unpleasant operating environment. And in fact, that could kill or harm critical infrastructure that we need. And so if you are dependent on a government income, if you're a government employee or your business is dependent on government income, you need to build your ability to either earn a private income or build your skills to do it yourself. So whether it's home repair or car repair, or many of the people I know who are most successful in this environment have dramatically expanded their do-it-yourself skills. If you like gardening and growing food, I'm very concerned that the cost of food may go up, but you absolutely want to see if you can't move your, whether through the income side of your financial statement or the expense side, more of your activities into the private side. You know, it's very specific to the situation. If your skills are relevant to the, you know, sort of the 3.0 economy, as I often call global 3.0, then you're going to be in demand whether you work in government or the private sector. But I think you want to be careful about the extent to which you depend on a government income, because the competition over those cash flows is going to get fierce, much fiercer than it is now. Fourth person who should care is a global citizen who operates under the national security umbrella of the United States. If the U.S. succeeds in maintaining its reserve currency, it's one world. If we lose it, it's another world. And you see all around the world many countries starting to build their own military capacity because they don't want to depend on the United States. So we have Japan now talking about building its own army. We have the EU taking the first steps towards an independently financed EU army. This all means radical increases the already unbearable military expenses because the U.S. is still spending a fortune. But the nature is it's going to mean more people fighting for less resources and the increased risk of war. And what we're talking about is the potential for a very different scenario coming from the United States. So this potentially could impact everyone globally. If a small group control the United States and decide to go to war, that's what's going to happen. Finally, I wanted to walk you through the web presentation for this annual wrap-up theme. We're going to organize a great deal of resources together, and I want to walk you through what they are. If you go to HUDmissingmoney.solaria.com, you can follow along with me. The first section is the introduction. Well, the first section is the table of contents. If you just click on The Real Game of Missing Money, you'll pull up the table of contents, and you can, of course, click to everything from there. The first section after the table of contents is the introduction, which is an overview of what's happening and why it's important. The second section is we have republished Dr. Skidmore's report. The original report was September 2017, and then there have been subsequent updates from 2017 through December 2018. And we also posted the graph that shows all the undocumentable adjustments at HUD and DOD from fiscal 1998 to 2015. I've asked Dr. Skidmore if he and his students can continue to bring us down to 2018, which he said he would do. So Dr. Skidmore's report is second. The next section is particularly significant for larger, serious investors. It's called U.S. Federal Finances, the Law. Money is a man-made construct. If you're going to understand money, you have to understand its governance and management, which means it's essential to understand the laws, rules, and regulations, because they reflect a society's agreement regarding what money that money is and who will oversee it and implement its monetary and fiscal operations and how those operations will work. In one sense, the financial system of currency, bonding, mortgage, and bank credit, taxation, and appropriations that was created and managed by the U.S. federal government is no different than, and I shouldn't say it was created by the U.S. federal government initially, it was created by Alexander Hamilton. I know because I named my last company after Alexander Hamilton, Hamilton Securities Group. Anyway, that system is no different than hopscotch or Monopoly or Dungeons and Dragons. Before you play, you need to know the rules of the game. So if you're going to understand the rules of the game of money, you got to understand the law. Now, learning the rules related and the law related to U.S. federal finances is challenging, particularly if you haven't gone to law school. And so after Dr. Skidmore published his report, I realized that it was going to be essential for journalists, for investors, and for concerned citizens to have a relatively easy way to understand the constitutional law and the financial management laws, as well as the black budget laws. So I commissioned two wonderful young attorneys to prepare briefing papers to summarize the legal infrastructure of the U.S. federal financial system. Those papers are public at constitution.solaria.com, but we've republished them here in the annual wrap-up so that we have everything in one section. The first paper is on the Federal Reserve System. If you want to understand the financial system, you need to understand how money is created. And the piece is called The History and Organization of the Federal Reserve, the What and Why of the United States' Most Powerful Banking Organization. And that's important because if you look at the ownership of the Federal Reserve banks, which is secret. They just say they're members, but they don't say exactly who and what percentage, let alone who control those members. So it's important to understand because it's that group that's basically running the federal credit mechanism. My assessment is that the institution of FASB 56 with the institution of PAYGO makes them significantly more powerful than they were when Trump became president, and they were pretty powerful then. The other papers all come under the category of fiscal, which is the U.S. Treasury. The first is on the appropriation clause of the U.S. Constitution. The second is on the financial management reporting requirements. The third is on the black budget, which is the sort of carve out for secret spending, which I would say is more than adequate to do that. And then the last that we published before the annual wrap up was the briefing paper on the Federal Accounting Standards Advisory Board Statement Number 56. We have a new paper that we just published contiguous with this publication of the annual wrap-up called National Security Exemptions and SEC Rule 10b-5, which goes much more to some of the things investors need to know as to how this impacts them specifically. After the legal section, the next section is called Why Should Investors Care? That is a piece that my attorney, Carolyn Betts, and I are writing to review the issues most important to investors, and I'm planning to post that by the end of next week. And if you're an investor doing due diligence, I would make sure you take a look at that. Next to that section, we put up a series of tables that show the different players. It's called Corporate Contractors and Dealers. And there are going to be four tables. Three of them are up. One is on the 100 largest contractors, and one is on the top brokers, and then one is a list of the primary dealers. And we include information regarding their stocks if they're publicly traded. Not all of them are, but some of them are. And you can manipulate, if you click on the different fields, you can change those tables around to take a look. These are companies, both contractors and financial institutions, that have deep commitments and involvement in the securities market. And if FASB 56 is happening, it's with their concurrence, one way or the other. As I said, those tables are flexible, so I would really go in and play with them. You'll get a much bigger sense of, or much better sense of, who the players are. The next section is called The Missing Money Story, 1989 to 2019. When I became Assistant Secretary of Housing, I never considered myself on the way to becoming an expert on the real federal finances. My goal was to make communities wonderful. I was interested in what I call the Popsicle Index. If you don't know what the Popsicle Index is, we have a little video. You just do a search for Popsicle Index at Solari or on a general search engine, and you'll pick it up. But the Popsicle Index is the percent of people in a place who believe a child can leave their home, go to the nearest place to buy a popsicle, and come home alone safely. And I was deeply concerned that there was a win-lose model between the Popsicle Index and the Dow Jones Index. The Dow Jones Index kept going up by things that were causing the Popsicle Index to go down. And it seemed to me it was going to be pretty easy to re-engineer the world to something that had a win-win relationship. So the Dow Jones could make money by people getting the Popsicle Index to go up. So I was just interested in creating a win-win model because I thought the wealth potential was extraordinary, and I wanted to live in a world where children were safe. One of the things that had happened to me before I went to HUD is I finally concluded, after many years of trying to figure out how I could take personal responsibility for the safety of a child in our society, I gave up. Essentially, I decided it was hard enough to coexist with the CIA without having trying to do it with a child. So what I discovered, of course, was the thing that causing the Popsicle Index to go down was a negative return on investment engineered through the federal budget, because the leadership wasn't interested in wealth. They were interested in control. And as a result, I've ended up spending 30 years trying to bring accountability to U.S. finances. But in the process, I was a witness to the financial coup, and I was a witness to all the different strategies that were used, not just by the leadership, but by the general population, to prevent financial accountability and to suppress the importance of what was going on. And so I thought it would help you to understand a history, at least the history I saw as events unfold. So I'm not here to present a case for the court of law or even present a case as an investigative reporter, but simply tell you as a witness what I watched. I plan to have that up by the end of the month. If you haven't watched the videos from Secret Space Program 2014 and 2015 for both Farrell and Fitz, I strongly recommend you watch it, including the panel that Farrell and Fitz did with some others at 2015. Those are up if you go to the section that we have, at the last section we have under The Real Game of Missing Money, which is Missing Money Movies and Documentaries. We have all those videos up, so there's one place where you can get them all. They're in the documentary section at the bottom. And it's a lot of stuff to watch, but I recommend it as very critical background to understanding the development of a hidden system of finance and black budget after World War II, and the growth of that system till it's simply overwhelmed and is taking over the overt economy. I'm also going to draw on many Solari Report resources. So for the people who are longtime Solari Report subscribers, they've already been through the material that serves as building blocks for what I'm going to present. One of the things I want to talk about is all the different tactics they use to kill the story. People always ask me, how did this story not go viral? You have no idea. It's like the joy of cooking. There are thousands of recipes of how you kill the story, and I think I've experienced most of them. I do recommend two things that you can also read that will really help you is the third quarter wrap-up we did in 2017 called Control 101. And that the major theme in that wrap-up will be very useful. It's the blue one with the waves going through the brain. And then Pension Fund, which was the 2017 annual wrap-up. If you go to pensionfund.solari.com, we made that available. It's really funny. I finished the big theme on that one. I was in the Netherlands in February of 2018. I finished the theme. The next morning, I got on the plane to fly back, and by the time I landed, 20 minutes before I landed, our site had been taken down, and it was so bad it was easier to bring up a new one than bring back the old one. But all I can tell you, so I was livid, so I made the Pension Fund web presentation available to the public. I said, okay. You take me down, I'll make it public. Anyway, so if you read Control 101, the third quarter 2017 wrap-up, and then the Pension Fund, the 2017 annual wrap-up, those two I think will make it easier for you to follow the material. And they're important building blocks. Another one, if you're a new subscriber, do a search and get my video on the Red Button story. And I've told the Red Button story so many times, I'm not going to tell it again, but it's very important to contemplate it and what it means to the complicity of the general population in how things got as bad as they got. Okay, so after my missing money story, 1989 to 2019, we have a section called the missing money chronology. What in the process of preparing the why should investors care, my attorney Carolyn Betts and I created a chronology to just pull out some of the key dates. And again, you can play with the field so you can look at it, the dates in ascending or descending order. But we also put a field to talk about what kind of event it was. Was it an article? Was it something related to Hamilton Securities? Remember, the key to making the financial coup d'etat go was you needed to pull all that money out of the federal accounts. So money had to start being transferred out of the federal accounts in very large amount. To do that, you had to scare a lot of good government types in Washington to death. You had to send a message to the civil service. You know, you better not mess with this, and you had to keep it secret. So slaughtering the team that was reengineering HUD and Hamilton with it, we were really at that point the brains supporting the operation, was critical to sending a message, you know, don't mess with us. I mean, if you mess with us, you're going to have, I mean, I was dealing with very serious physical harassment. So it was enough to scare anybody to death. Finally, the next section is the Solari Heroes, the Missing Money Hall of Fame. Never say to me, why is nobody doing anything? If you look at the list, what you will see is there were many people who stood up and took enormous risks and were very courageous and brilliant in their defense of financial integrity. And we owe them a great deal of appreciation. And most of all, we owe them the recognition that there are many excellent people standing up for human civilization in a very powerful way. They're quite a group of people. They've done amazing things, and they absolutely deserve your admiration. I'm always shocked and amazed at what a significant difference people like that can make, despite having very little support. I think the time has come when I'm hoping the world can start sending a lot more support to the people fighting for them and supporting them as opposed to the guys stealing from them. I was listening to a Leonard Cohen song the other night, and there was a great line. It said, many men have fallen where you promised to stand guard. And that is what reminds me of so many people in the leadership of this country. They promised to stand guard, and instead many people have fallen. And what is heartbreaking is the extent to which the people who are falling still support them. And I can never understand or fathom why. The final section is movies and documentaries. There are so many great tools to educate yourself, especially those secret space program videos that I put up. So if you haven't seen them, that's great background for the other pieces that we'll be publishing before the end of the month. In conclusion, I want to tell you one of my favorite quotes that you often see on the Solaria Report from Sir Peter Medawar. He said, "What is relevant is what solves the problem. If we had thought through real relevancies, we would be on Sirius by now." It's quite extraordinary. The issue of the missing money and the federal finances and the corruption in the federal finances and the fraud in the federal finances, ultimately, this is the issue that decides who rules. If I can print as much money as I want as the Fed owners, and then I can spend money on a secret basis, even though I'm taking it from securities raised on the U.S. Treasury credit with the backing of the citizens or with their tax dollar, if I can spend as much of that money on a secret basis, combined with the ability to deliver physical violence secretly and with impunity, hiding behind a one-way mirror with a population that has zero privacy, then the people don't have any sovereignty and the government doesn't have any sovereignty. So this is about who rules and the conditions under which they can control and rule. FASB Statement 56 has finished the conversion to secret governance by secret society. Not to say that wasn't going on before, but it was going on in the covert side. Now it's running everything. And it's a very somber picture. However, if 5 to 10% of the U.S. population and the investment community take the time to understand and to act, at best, the picture can change. At worst, that 5 to 10% can significantly improve their chance of succeeding on the road ahead. We are in the middle of a reordering and reorganizing of institutions, which will accelerate throughout the year. We need to each think about what that could mean to us and prepare accordingly. I expect to have the full web presentation up by the end of the month. One possibility is that I do a live Solaria Report session in February on the missing money so I can take questions live and we can discuss it live. Let me know if that would be of interest. I expect that we will have the hard copies out to the print and digital subscribers by late February, early March. We can also do a session then after you've had some time to work with the materials in a hard copy. If you have not converted to a print and digital subscriber so that you automatically receive the hard copy, now may be a good time to do it before this one comes out. Or you can always buy the hard copy at the store when they are available. Given the denseness of the material, particularly the legal issues, I find it much easier to read this in a hard copy. And of course, you can always get that by printing out the PDF and the flipbook when they're available. So please check out the web presentation and look at the last few pieces to publish between now and the end of the month at hudmissingmoney.solaria.com. So I want to thank you for taking the time to investigate and understand this because it is a critical issue. And of course, I have to close as I always do. Don't ask if there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, 2019 would be a really good year to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.